Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Elisa Canu and I am neuropsychologist and researcher at the San Raffaele Hospital in Milan, currently serving as co-chair of the EAN Scientific Panel on Higher Cortical Functions. My research focuses on the structural and functional correlates of cognitive and behavioral features in neurodegenerative disorders. This month's topic is the interaction between language and motor system, and in today's episode, we will talk about something like related to more than word, the neuroscience of human voices. And my guest today is Professor Sophie Scott. She is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University College London, UCL, and she served as director of UCL Institution of Cognitive Neuroscience, where she is also head of the Speech Communication Group. Her research investigates the cognitive neurosciences of voices, speech, and laughter, particularly speech perception, speech production, vocal emotions, and human communication. Welcome, Professor Scott, and thank you for joining us today.
Hello, and thank you very much for your kind invitation. Thank you.
Thanks. So, Professor, for many years, the relationship between the motor system and speech has been at the center of an intense scientific debate. From your perspective, what are the most important advances that have changed our understanding of how speech perception and speech production interact?
I think one really, really big change was developments in the 1990s, where people started getting better neuroanatomical models of how primate hearing works. And that showed us that, as in the visual system, there's not just one thing that happens during perception. You've got this streaming of information, exactly the same as in the visual system. And you've got this kind of a recognition pathway is distinct from a sensory motor interaction pathway. And potentially there's more pathways than that, but these are clear kind of points to sort of start to map out different aspects of the speech perception network. So when you're listening to speech, part of what's happening is listening for meaning, and part of what's happening is listening to a sound that you could make, and mm-hmm. a sound you're probably about to make because you usually use speech in a conversation. And then I think in parallel with that, we also now have a much better understanding of the complexity of the motor control networks involved in, well, motor control in general. More of the work here has happened in the manual system than in the articulatory system, because that's easier to study in other primates. But you get this profile of, as motor acts become more complex. So if I go to London Zoo and look at the squirrel monkeys, they have hands that look a bit like my hands, but they use them very differently. They can't move their fingers individually, for example. And that affects how they interact with objects. And what you find is, very roughly, as you look across more and more complex manual control in primates, what you find is a more complex pattern of motor control. And that pattern of motor control involves sort of overlapping parallel systems that seem to be involved. So we've got primary motor cortex, but we've also got supplementary motor cortex, and we've got premotor cortex, all involved in actually kind of direct control of the hands. And that seems to me a very good reason for thinking something similar is likely to be happening with motor control of articulation in humans. We should be looking for kind of complex overlapping parallel motor systems. And that's something that, you know, people like David Ostrey has been talking about a lot in Montreal. And then that kind of makes it all more interesting when you start to think about how these two, very crudely, these systems we think of as being separate interact. And of course, we know that perception is absolutely essential for production to occur. So if you have even mild hearing loss, it will affect your ability to acquire speech, because when you are speaking, part of what you're doing is you're guiding what you are doing by what it sounds like, and of course also what it feels like with its somatosensation. And David Ostry has argued from that perspective, you should think of parts of the brain like primary motor cortex as being sensory cortex because it's getting so much input from vision and hearing and touch. I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about, you know, a massive interaction between perception and production is the way that perception is basically essential for production. You can almost think of the brain, job of the brain as perception. Sometimes you're perceiving what's out there in the world and the rest of the time you're perceiving what you are doing. So I think that's been really helpful. And I think also kind of starting to think that because brain areas are involved in similar tasks, that they might not be doing the same thing. So for example, you can find primary motor cortex that responds when you hear sounds. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's involved in recognizing those sounds. It could be part of that kind of sensory motor preparation or tracking. It's an argument we've made. Now, you know, these, as you say, these are still massively under debate. But I think something that's really helped is being able to take these models from other primates and actually use that to start to appreciate how complex these systems are and how the interactions between perception and production are likely to be happening in lots of different ways, basically.
And how you do briefly describe the current role of the motor system in understanding spoken language and what evidence has been most convincing in shaping your view?
I think the most convincing argument is that it's strongly involved in the representation of meaning. So we know that when the brain represents meaning, it does it partly in an abstract way. There do seem to be parts of the brain that represent semantic information in a kind of very abstract, hierarchical way. So the anterior temporal lobes seem to be important for that. But we also know that that's not happening. That's not the only place where information is stored. So as soon as there's any kind of embodied information, so for example, visual information associated with that word or auditory information, you will start to see the semantic system drawing those regions in. So you get activation in visual parts of the brain when you hear a word that's highly easily imaged, like glove, and much less so for a word that is abstract in its representation, like love. And within that framework, there's a really important role for motor areas in representing verbs. And Friedman Pulvermüller showed that if you are listening to words like kick, lick, and pick, yeah, which are all referring to actions, but they're actions made with different parts of the body, you see different parts of the motor system recruited as part of that kind of, you know, embodied representation of knowledge. There's a persistent belief that primary motor cortex is involved in the direct decoding of speech. And I think that's harder to show, for example, patients who have severe problems of speech production with a Broca's aphasia don't have a straight down the line problem with understanding speech. That, you know, they often have these brain areas compromised and they are still able to understand speech. Now, they can have difficulty doing sort of some complex phonetic tasks on speech, you know, spitting up a sound into phonemes, for example. And there is a lot of evidence that when you're doing that, when you're mapping between sort of a word and its phonemic elements, that does seem to require a level of segmentation that does start to recruit primary motor cortex. And I think that's interesting because we know that when children are learning to read, even if they are learning to read, a script like Chinese, which is not made up of letters, it really helps children to be able to break words down into their phonemes. And that seems to be an important pre-stage to acquiring the ability to read. And that, so that does imply, you know, that kind of, along with other kind of, Charlotte Jacquemot has argued, other kind of like verbal working memory tasks really require the speech perception and the speech production system to work together very closely. So I think you've also got this kind of like added value of what you get from how speech perception, speech production systems interact, and that they can lead to the sort of segmentation skills that mean you can read, and they lead to the sort of representation of words in your head without having to say them aloud or having to keep listening to them, where you can do working memory tasks on the words and, you know, maintain something in working memory before you can write it down, that kind of thing. Do a maths problem in your head, that kind of thing. So I think that's an enormous sort of added value of having these complex speech perception, speech production networks, and that really interesting things can start happening for other cognitive domains when they interact.
Yeah, on this report, your work argued that speech production relies on a distributed network rather than a single speech area. How has our understanding of broadcast area changed over the years, and what role do you think it plays today?
That's a very good question. I think one of the things that we learned very early on with functional imaging studies was that classic Broca's area, the posterior third of the inferior frontal gyrus on the left, that is really recruited for a lot of different tasks, are things that even aren't apparently linguistic in any way, although maybe language, maybe inner thought is a way of kind of helping you do some of these tasks. It's not just doing speech production for sure. And it is clearly very involved in speech production. And it is also the case that if you test people with Broca's aphasia, they will have problems that aren't limited to speech production. So it's clearly quite an important hub. Peter Haggard in Nijmegen, he was really interested in it as a cognitive element, part of a much wider distributed system for control and executive function. And it's in prefrontal cortex. It's a part of the brain that is and beyond. So it is definitely in brain areas that would plausibly have not just a linguistic function. The frontal cortex is often a very generalist part of the brain, so you would expect that. What I think personally is it does seem to be, Nina Dronka showed pretty convincingly it's not just doing articulation. If you have lesions to the anterior insula, that's where you start to get really profound problems of being able to articulate. Whereas if something's constrained just to Broca's area, the lesion itself is just constrained to Broca's area, people show transient mutism and then often recover some speech production. And that's J.P. Moore's work. So what you do seem to need something bigger for classic Broca's aphasia. You do seem to need to damage not just the cortical area in the posterior third of the inferior frontal gyrus, but also what it's connecting to. And I think that's interesting to think about. I would probably say it's not doing the direct control of articulation or even necessarily planning, but I think planning is probably important and some sort of kind of higher order control. But in that it has to be working with these overlapping systems in the, in premotor cortex and in the supplementary motor area, for example. And also, we got this really intriguing finding years and years and years ago. This is work by Katrin Blank that showed, you got people doing a speech production task in the scanner and you get Broca's area, which you'd expect to see. If you take patients who have had a Broca's aphasia stroke and have recovered speech production and you scan them, you get right Broca's area activated, which is interesting to see, and it makes sense. We've got sort of recovery of function in this homologous brain area. But if you actually look to what happened in right Broca's area when people, the neurotypical people were being scanned, it was being suppressed. It was being actively unactive. It was showing suppression. And there is something interesting there, because as soon as you start changing the voice task that you're using, so you get people, instead of they're talking, you ask them to sing, you start to see lots of stuff happening in right Broca's area. So there's something very interesting there happening in the kind of dynamism of the left and the right and how they are talking to each other. So I think there's a lot more to know about that.
Nice. Yeah. And one of the central ideas in your paper is the distinction between the auditory what and how pathways, and how these two systems cooperate during the everyday communication.
So you've got this kind of these streams of processing that I talked about in the primate brain, and one's running forward from primary auditory cortex down the temporal lobe, and the other is running back up into sort of parietal cortex. And that rostral stream that anterior going stream, that's the recognition pathway, and this more the caudal stream, the thing running back up into the parietal lobe, that's what we think of as a sensory motor pathway. I think in normal conversation, like what we're doing now, what you get is, you know, we take turns when we're speaking to each other. So we don't just talk and understand each other. We also align our voices and we start to pick up on the rhythm of the other person's speech, and we start to pick up on their breathing, and we start to pick up on the pitch of their speech. So in other words, you align your voice with the person you're talking to as well as listen to them. And I think in conversational speech, the sensory motor pathway is important, obviously, when you're talking, because it's helping control that. We know this. But when you're listening, I think it's the sensory motor pathway that is picking up on the rhythm and the pitch and the sort of things like breath pattern of the other speaker while you are understanding what they're saying in that rostral recognition pathway. And they're working together to mean that you are able to take over your turn when it's your turn to speak or indicate that you'd like to speak. Pretty effortlessly. If you look at how closely people time conversational speech, there are very rarely long gaps between sentences and people very rarely overlap each other. And that to me looks like the motor system is involved in, you know, in that kind of timing profile. So that's, I mean, there are people who would wildly disagree with me on this, but I think that's what's happening. So it's not that the recognition network is only activated when you're listening to somebody. If you're talking to them, then the sensory motor stuff is probably always there.
Nice, very interesting. And about speech in social communication, in your work, you argue that speech is much more than language. It also conveys identity, emotion, and social meaning. Mm-hmm. Why do you think neuroscience has traditionally underestimated these non-linguistic aspects of speech?
I suspect because aphasia, when somebody has a problem producing speech or understanding speech, it's so devastating. You can completely understand why that's a problem of language, or perceived classically as a problem of language. And again, as soon as you encounter somebody talking to you, you are aware of understanding the words they're saying or not. And that seems to be what we're engaged in here is the business of language. And what we are, I think we've just kind of not paid enough attention to the fact that as soon as there's somebody talking, there's a voice. There's no speech without the sound of someone talking or something talking. And it's an intentionally social cue. There's a lot of information in that talking voice. And people will try and read all sorts of information, get all sorts of information out of that, even if it's wrong. You know, so I've a few times, because I sometimes do a bit of radio in the UK, and a few times I've met people who have only heard me on the radio, and they're always surprised at how old I am. So I sound to them, I sound younger than I am. But that we're all doing that all the time, because, and there's so much information about somebody when they're talking. As soon as they're talking, we're getting the words they say, but we're also getting information about their whether they're male or female. We're getting information about their age. Age has a huge effect on the voice. We're getting information about whether or not they're unwell, because that will often affect the voice. We're getting information about their mood, because their emotional state will affect their voice. And probably everybody's had the experience of talking to somebody on the phone and they were going, "No, I'm not angry." And you think, I think you're a little bit angry. But you also get information about their origins. So we're vocal learners. You know, we learn the language from the people around us who are teaching us to speak. They don't do it explicitly, but we learn from them. And that means we learn not just the words they're saying, but also how they talk. So, you know, you've got geographical origins are in your voice, and also your socioeconomic status. So in the UK, there's something called TH fronting. And that means saying instead of month or throw, you say month or throw. And as soon as you start, if you just take recordings of somebody's voice and you edit it such that instead of saying "I'll throw that next month," they're saying "I'll throw that next month," people will rate that person as being less employable. Now, you know nothing about the person from how they speak. You literally tells you nothing. But people make and automatically make this assumption because it is a marker of a lower social status. It's not a posh way of speaking. And that's something that's very kind of, people can be very blind to that kind of assumption. And also, of course, voices are very affiliative. So, and voices are something that change. So our voices do change all the time. They change on a long span over our lifetimes, but they also change minute to minute, depending on who you are, where you are, who you're talking to. So I come from the north of England. And when I go back to the north of England, my accent changes completely because I'm sort of showing affiliation with the people around me. And then back in London, I talk like this again because I don't want them to think I'm some country bumpkin, you know. And that's not, it's not a particularly overt decision, but it's a very common thing people do. And then it's very, it can get really affiliative. So the more you like somebody, the more you will change your voice to speak like them. And, you know, when I talk to my mother on the phone, I sound exactly like her for quite a long time afterwards. My husband can tell if I've been talking to my mum on the phone because many things about our lives are very, very different. But, you know, I take my voice over to her to show how much I am like her. And that's something people do a great deal. So there's a very kind of sort of social affiliative element to voices. And I think that's really interesting. And again, sort of missing from our, if we just think of it as speech, we miss that social and emotional dimension.
So, so interesting. And what about patients with aphasia? Often they report that they no longer sound like themselves. And even after recovering much of their speech, do you think preserving vocal identity should become an explicit goal of speech rehabilitation or treatment?
I mean, I do agree. It's really is something worth taking seriously. I've heard a patient describe aphasia as being like identity theft, because even if you make some, you know, even if you make good speech recovery, chances are you will not sound the way you did. And I worked with a woman who had a specific form of speech apraxia, which is called foreign accent syndrome. And it just means you basically have a dyspraxia of speech or an apraxia of speech that to your fellow countrymen happens to make you sound like you are speaking with a foreign accent. Of course, you're not actually speaking with a foreign accent. And she carried around with her a cassette player and a tape of when she'd been on the radio in taking part in a competition a few years previously. And she would make you listen to that before you had a conversation with her, so you knew what she should sound like. She was like, that's me, that's what I should sound like. And of course that voice was lost to her. And I think we, again, understandably, speech and language therapy focuses on getting the speech sounds right, because, you know, speech really matters and getting the details matters. But what people, it doesn't really get to that loss of identity. And how can you, even if you can't ever restore that, and it may not be possible, how can we support people in dealing with a loss of identity in a very profound way?
Very nice. And one of the most intriguing ideas in your papers is the increasing involvement of right hemisphere regions during vocal modulation, joint speech and singing. And I'm a fan of the right hemisphere. I need to acknowledge that. And what do you think is the fundamental contribution of the right hemisphere to voluntary vocal production?
I'm not certain I can give you a good answer, but exactly as you say, and I briefly referred to it earlier, as soon as you get away from just speech, you start seeing a much greater contribution of the right frontal lobe in particular, but also temporal lobe during speech production or vocal production. That's all sorts of singing. When we had people trying to do impersonations of other people, we started seeing it. It's very interesting because it almost makes me think that singing, and we are starting to move in this direction, singing, which seems to give you much more bilateral activation, maybe that's the starting point for volitional motor control of the voice. Maybe we were singing before we were talking. And instead of thinking of, well, we've got speech and we've got song, we should think of song as being maybe what we evolved our voices for, potentially. And speech is a really weird version of that, where you kind of don't do the musical stuff as much, although we always speak with rhythm and melody. There's no, we don't talk to each other like that, it would be strange. So there's always a music to speech, but you don't get that kind of repetition and the structure that you get in song. and you get a different kind of vocal control. So I think that maybe it's speech that's the odd thing, because it's so strongly lateralized to the left, certainly in terms of the sort of the frontal areas. And that's and maybe that kind of suppression of Broca's that I was talking about, maybe that's deliberate. It's to stop you from singing, you know, and that's just a guess. But I think we might need to think about, we might need to let our vision of what the vocalization network is doing, why it's there, we might need to sort of unstick ourselves from assuming that it's all about speech. There might be, you know, if the origins of the voice lie in something maybe more musical that gets us to speech, that might, you know, that's a kind of a, that's sort of where I'm starting to go now. So from that context, I think as soon as you have any kind of musicality in sound, and that doesn't have to be vocal, the right hemisphere starts to be dominant. So it likes sounds that have pitch variation. It likes sounds that are longer rather than shorter. It likes all the other kind of nonverbal information in the voice. It likes emotion. Not that the left doesn't, but its right seems to like it a bit more. It's really involved in vocal identity, which is not determined solely by pitch, but pitch is really important for vocal identity. So there's a lot of things that are sort of saying, as soon as you kind of zoom out and say, we just get ourselves away from words and phonemes, not they're not important, they're very important, and grammar, which have a left bias, there's something kind of like this. It's almost if you kind of think of the structural elements of that, that the phonemes and the words can sit on, that's where the music matters.
Nice. And you did a lot of work also with laughter. And laughter is often considered one of the simplest human vocalizations. Yet your work shows that it engages remarkable sophisticated neural mechanisms. What makes laughter such a powerful model for studying social communication?
That's another very good question. I mean, I went into this because I was looking at nonverbal expressions of emotion in the voice. You know, if you're really frightened, you scream. You don't just say, I am frightened. And that was what I was looking at. And I started looking at more positive emotions as well as negative. And I was including laughter because I thought that was interesting. And I thought that's what you do when something's funny. And I called it amusement. And there was a psychologist in America called Robert Provine, and he was arguing that laughter, actually, if you look at it, is a social behavior. So you're much more likely to laugh if there's somebody else with you than if you're on your own. And you'll laugh more if you know that person, and you'll laugh more if you like that person. And I slowly, over the years, came to realize he was right. We do laugh when things are funny, but most of the time when we laugh, we are laughing for a host of other potential reasons. So if you kind of zoom out and look at laughter in mammals, mammals laugh when they're playing, they laugh when they're being tickled. It's a physical, joyful, fun activity that seems to be important in bonding and, of course, learning through play. And humans do both those things. We laugh when we're tickled, we laugh when we're playing. But we also laugh in this kind of host of other ways. So humans are the only animals that laugh contagiously. We can catch laughs from other humans. And contagious behaviors are quite common in nature, but only humans show contagious laughter. And we also laugh in a way that's very kind of, it gives away a lot about the social setting that we're in. So I said you laugh more when you're with people that you know. You actually laugh differently when you're with people that you know versus laughing with strangers. So there's people, and people can hear the difference in that. And we will laugh communicatively. People will, in a conversation, people will use laughter to show they understand, they recognize, they remember the same event. And in fact, Provine found that any one point in time, the person who's talking is the person who laughs most. So that's like people are communicating or trying to get people to show they remember, they understand. So it's a very, very strong communicative signal. And people will use laughter to deal with stressful situations, to try and de-escalate a stressful situation. And people will use laughter to cover up other emotional states. I was listening to a podcast a while ago where a woman was talking about a dog that passed away, and she started crying and she laughed to get herself out of the car. And that's a very, very common use. And in fact, it could be doing all those things at once. And of course, also, we do laugh when things are funny. So it can be, the same laugh might be friendly, contagious, showing understanding and is making everybody feel a bit less stressed. And of course, always contributing to feeling closer in your social bonds. So I think it's really interesting that we drop into this ancient mammal vocalization really precisely in conversational speech, because that's where most laughter lives, is in a conversation. Yeah. That's what humans do when we're together. So we've got speech sitting there, and then we drop into this ancient mammal, really simple vocalization to do a lot of the kind of emotional elements of the interaction.
And your findings also suggest that activity in the pre-supplementary motor areas predicts how contagious and authentic a laugh is perceived to be. What do you think a motor region plays such a central role in understanding another person's emotions?
Sorry, I keep telling you it's a good question, but that is really interesting. We know that the supplementary motor area in total, supplementary, pre-supplementary and supplementary, that does seem to be very involved in initiating laughter. So studies where people have kind of stimulated there, you can get laughter happening. We think that one of the things that's happening with laughter is that, as I say, it's contagious, and it's very, it's a learned behavior. You look at babies, they don't show any contagious behaviors. They don't blink contagiously or yawn contagiously or laugh contagiously. And these are all things we teach babies to do. And we think that one of the things we think is happening with the pre-SMA is it is part of that priming, that learned association. You've heard it and you do it yourself. It would be interesting to know if you saw that with other contagious behaviours. So we need to do more studies there. But that's my current guess. It's part of that kind of really rapid priming network. Mm-hmm. And that's why the more active it is when people are listening to the laughter, the more contagious they rate that laughter, because you're directly getting an experience of that contagion.
And one of the fascinating aspects of your work is the distinction between spontaneous and volitional laughter. From an evolutionary perspective, what do you think humans have developed these two different forms of laughter?
I think it's because we have two different motor networks. So everything that we were talking about for the first, half of the show was about the volitional control of the voice in speaking and singing and whatever else you're doing. And that we know uses these lateral motor areas. I'm unhelpfully pointing to my head, but basically, primary motor cortex, primary sensory cortex, auditory cortex, these sort of lateral motor and sensory fields are really important in guiding volitional action. In contrast, we also have a vocalization network that we share with other mammals, which runs from the anterior cingulate down to the brainstem nuclei and directly controls the muscles of articulation. And that, in other mammals, is what drives vocalizations. And of course, vocalizations in other mammals are very reactive and emotional. They do very little sort of volitional control of the voice, unlike us. But of course, we do also produce sounds in an involuntary way. So I was walking down the street once and I slipped on some leaves and I thought I was going to fall over, and I made a real kind of oh sound like that. It's completely involuntary and of no use whatsoever, but I could not stop it coming out. And in fact, in patients who have damage that leaves them with an aphasic syndrome, so they've damaged the lateral motor areas involved in articulation, they can still laugh. And they can still cry and swear, and lots of this kind of highly overlearned, very emotional bits of vocalizations are preserved. So it looks like we have this older pathway, which is involved in really involuntary or maybe very highly overlearned use of the voice, but always emotional. And then we've got this more volitional network for everything else. So I think laughter, when you think about the last time you were laughing and you could not stop, that's almost certainly that involuntary network, that midline network, because an involuntary sound has been triggered and it's just going to happen. There's no way you can stop this. In contrast, I think a lot of the laughter that happens in conversation, because it's timed so precisely, that looks to me like the lateral motor system. And I've just published a paper with the Italian neuroscientist Fausto Caruana, where he had this did this lovely meta-analysis looking at brain stimulation and looking at where, when you stimulate in the brain, you get laughter and whether or not people feel mirth with the laughter. And you do get a distinction. So if you go in these more kind of lateral motor areas, people laugh, but it's not funny. Where in the kind of more lit midline, older emotional network, involuntary network, and the supplementary motor cortex, I think that's when you start to see something that people experience as mirthful. So there's something very interesting there. And we think that there may be key points in the brain like the anterior cingulate and the SMA where these two networks join up. But there's, and maybe something interesting about laughter where maybe we can count bounce back and forth between that voluntary and involuntary laughter. But it definitely, to me, speaks to two different kinds of systems.
Very, very interesting. And on your experience, which tools more than others helped you to understand all these processes? Which instruments, like TMS, so neuromodulation, or functional MRI, or which are the, you know, of NIRS, which are the instruments that more than others helped you to understand this processing?
I think they're complementary. I think you learn different things from all of them. So I've learned a lot from doing fMRI because you see the networks. And then I've learned a lot with fNIRS because you can do much more kind of naturalistic things. People aren't lying in the scanner. You're in the room with them. And then I've learned, and you get that kind of, you know, seeing that relationship between SMA activation and people's ratings actually happening as a direct measure. And then I've learned a lot from the work that Fausto has been doing with, you know, kind of stimulation studies. So really fine-grained anatomical detail about exactly where you are in the brain. And that's telling you with enormous precision, not just where do you get laughter generated, but what does it feel like? So to me, I think a really complex behavior like human use of laughter, it benefits from having a lot of different possible ways of going in. You know, and I've also done cross-cultural studies with laughter. That's been really helpful. And I've done you know, kind of questionnaire studies of laughter, so looking at people's individual experiences. So I think it really does kind of, you need to, with most human behaviors, you benefit from taking more than one stance. And I'd love to try some experiments with TMS, see if we could stop people laughing.
Yeah. And what about recording the voices of patients, not only aphasic patients, but patients with neurological disorders, for instance, can help us to understand better the disease itself, the progression, the prognosis. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so, because again, often the focus is on the linguistic content of what people are saying, but there will be other changes. So, you know, I mean, Parkinson's disease really can affect the voice. It can affect both the ability to speak, but also, you know, to manage musicality in the voice. People's voice can become flat or very quiet. And as I say, there are also conditions where the main problem is the sort of nonverbal element. So somebody with quotes foreign accent syndrome, they can still speak reasonably fluently, but there's a distortion to the sounds that are causing quite a different identity to be expressed. So I think a better understanding of what's exactly going on is going to be really helpful for both embracing the complexity of the problems we face, but also hopefully helping patients, even if it's only helping patients with coming to terms with what's happened.
And you will record them in a natural conversation, in an ecological way. I mean,
Probably do both, because you get really nice recordings if you take somebody into an anechoic chamber, which not everybody is a very not natural environment. But also, if you look at people talking together, you'll also be able to pick up on how much they change their voice to be like the person they're talking to. You know, and that would be how much they're able to do. That would be a really useful index of, you know, what kind of changes have happened and what potential things you could do to support them.
Very nice. So thank you, Professor Scott. It has been a great pleasure to talk with you today. And I enjoy reading all your papers, and you have done a lot of work on the field. and thank you for joining us today. And I say bye to all our listeners and you in particular.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.